Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Frank Beckwith, responding to Mormon truth claims. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. We have the live-in studio email address as well, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Wade is on the line. Wade, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. I have a two-part question. I'm getting the feeling, working with some of these Mormon missionaries, that I'm not getting the full truth from them. And that might be their tactic that they use to win me to their cult, that they believe it's a greater good if they hold back information. I've been trying to be very honest with them. And with that being said, how much time on average does it take meetings with Mormon missionaries before it's our duty to shake the dust off our feet?
Okay, those are two good questions, Wade. First, what about the full disclosure? Will you commonly get the straight poop from a Mormon missionary?
Yeah, I mean, I think Mormon missionaries won't lie to you, but they will oftentimes put forth their theology in a way that they know will be more palatable to the ordinary non-Mormon Christian. I think, though, that we have to remember that these are usually very young men and women who aren't all that sophisticated theologically, and so it may very well be that many times, even though they know the Mormon story, in fact, they show you the Mormon story with pictures and paintings and so forth, they may not fully grasp what exactly their theology teaches, although I think a vast majority of them, in fact, do. In terms of the question of when is enough, it's when talking with them, that's difficult to answer. I don't think there's really a bright line. I do think, though, that and I've had some experience with this. Usually, it's the Mormon that cuts it off before you do. And so, I think as long as the lines of communication are open and there is an openness and a listening and a willingness to dialogue, even if they don't convert, and it's unlikely that they will, still you will have an opportunity to plant some seeds. So, it's difficult to know what, you know, I don't think there's a bright line that where you know immediately that you should stop, but my experience has been that they usually stop first. One experience I had about 20 years ago where I had one missionary who was calling me at home and who was very interested in what I was saying, and he was reassigned. It's pretty clear that I was getting through.
Well, and one piece of advice, Wade, is when it's the door-to-door encounter and they've come to my home, I will usually specify amount of time that I want to spend talking with them, but I make a deal at the very outset. I tell them I'm a Lutheran pastor. I'm probably not a good prospect for conversion to Mormonism. Let's be honest about that up front. Can we take the 20 minutes that you asked of me, and can I use it to ask you some questions? And I do that kind of diagnostic question asking. And then I always invite them back. They don't always come back.
Yes.
But I always invite them back because I never want to miss a future opportunity with them. Even if I get tired of it, I always ask them back. Faith is up next calling. Faith, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. I've got a question about prayer. I've got a Mormon friend who told me that she's praying for me, and I wonder who she's praying to. And I also have another question. She talks about having to go to the temple and doing temple work and making a temple dress and all that. And it seems to be a very stressful thing. She makes her children go and they're supposed to go and be baptized for other people, for relatives. And it just seems so law orientated. I wonder if that might be a way of reaching them too and just saying, you know, how long are you going to keep doing all these things and why are you doing them?
Faith, thank you very much. Frank?
Yeah, great questions. For Mormons, the temple is really the center of their quest for salvation, and to be a Mormon in good standing with the church, one is able to enter the temple for a number of different rites and services, including marriage, which is really central to the Mormon worldview, because gender is something that is not lost in the afterlife, that there will be men and women in the afterlife, and that one continues in one's marriage for all eternity. So when Mormons say marriage is for eternity, they don't mean it metaphorically. They mean it literally. And so it's an important aspect of their faith. I do think, though, that one of, and I'm not sure if the caller was raising this point, but I think it's important when talking to Mormons to try to find something in common, and to discuss, let's say this caller was a Lutheran, to talk about, let's say, the Lutheran liturgy, and say, geez, I'd like to see how that compares to what you undergo in your temple, or what sort of services and ceremonies that you engage in. And I think it's an important sort of wedge to get the discussion going. I've discovered as a social conservative that I've had a lot of opportunities to talk with Mormons because of our similar, let's say, political views on questions like abortion or gay marriage and things of that sort, and that has opened doors to discuss other theological issues. So there's lots of ways that that Mormons and evangelicals and other Christians can talk to one another, and I think it's important to find those common elements.
One of the things that Faith mentioned, I think, is a good opportunity, and that is, and I think you added well to it, Frank, to say, look, this is what I do when I go to church on Sunday. This is what happens there. I'm hearing the gospel. I'm hearing about the forgiveness of my sins. This is something I need every day. I'm a sinner who needs this, and I'm being told that forgiveness was purchased and won for me entirely by the deeds of Jesus Christ in his perfect life and his death for me and his resurrection. Now, what are you hearing about in the temple again? I mean, to contrast the goodness of the gospel, which I think they have a passing familiarity with, with what they are being required to undergo in the temple or what they're being exposed to when they meet at the ward every once in a while. In answer to her question, who are the Mormons praying to?
Oh, yes, I forgot about that one. Thanks for reminding me. Boy, that's an interesting question. I think it depends on what Mormon you talk to. I do think that there are people in the Mormon church that are, in fact, really Christians. They are in the church. They are Christians despite the fact of Mormon theology. I don't think Mormon theology is Christian by any means, but I do think that there are individuals in the church who have, in spite of Mormon theology, truly come to Christ, not because of Mormon theology. I hope everyone understands that clarification. But so I think it depends on the individual Mormon. I think I do think that God will honor a prayer sincerely offered to him. I do think, though, that if somebody has an idea of God that is false, and they think they're praying to the true God, that's not a prayer to the true God. But I think it depends on the individual Mormon.
Yeah, the simple fact is that Scripture is quite clear that apart from faith in Jesus Christ, one cannot be assured that God hears or answers prayers. This is Christ's point. So
that's right.
That would be the question for the individual Mormon. Let's talk about neo-orthodoxy in Mormonism. Some have said that this Mormon neo-orthodoxy is closer to Protestant fundamentalism than it is to old Mormonism.
Yeah, I've heard that many writers have said that. O. Kendall White, who's a sociologist from University of Washington, wrote a famous book about 15 years ago called Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy, a fascinating book. Just remarkable. It opened my eyes to a group of Mormon intellectuals, many of whom were educated at prestigious institutions in certain divinity schools, and they came in contact with Reformation theology. And so you find among many Mormons, I think especially on the issue of salvation, a movement away from works righteousness and a clear move to salvation by grace through faith, and a rejection of the sort of traditional Mormon view of works and their ability to bring people to salvation. And I actually think of all the issues in which within Mormonism, I think the issue of salvation, that is the role of works, not whether they're really saved or not, but their view of how of the relationship between one's deeds and one's salvation. Many Mormon intellectuals have moved, I think, considerably away from what many of us in the evangelical community were taught that Mormons actually believed. Now, concerning their view of God, even there, many of these same Mormons who were educated at these institutions have felt uncomfortable with the Mormon view that God is a body and that he was once not God. Stephen Robinson, for example, in his book that he co-authored with Craig Blomberg, writes that he said, you know, that the view that God was once a man is not part of Mormon scripture. A lot of Mormons believe it, and Joseph Smith may have taught it. Now, we know that he, in fact, did teach it. But you see, there's an uneasiness about it, and I think it's largely because these men and women learned while they're in graduate school why classical theologians believed in the classical view of God. And they see that that the Mormon view is inconsistent with that, and they've learned to respect those classical theologians, whether it's Luther, Augustine, Aquinas, or Calvin. So I think what this Mormon New Orthodoxy, it's not to be confused with Protestant New Orthodoxy. It's New Orthodox in the sense that it is a return to or an attempt to return to something that incorporates many traditional notions of that is found within Protestant Christianity. It's clearly not Protestant Christianity. That is, there's still ideas and doctrines that are not, in my judgment, biblical, but it is a movement away from traditional Mormonism.
Is it possible that Mormonism, at least a sector of it, is migrating toward Christianity, making very clear that, of course, in its external teachings, we do not have things that are Christian?
Yeah.
But is it migrating toward Christianity?
I think it's certainly possible. You know, I actually told a friend of mine who's a fiction writer that would be a wonderful novel to write about, say, a Mormon president who suffers a crisis of conscience about the truth of traditional Mormonism and tries to figure out a way to move the church. I do think that there is a movement. I don't know whether it would ever be successful. My friend Craig Blomberg and I have this ongoing debate about this. He thinks that it is possible. And I think I'm much more skeptical. I do think that there's a movement in that direction, but the problem is just the enormity of the writings by Joseph Smith, in which he says things that are clearly inconsistent with classical Christianity, and we are told that he's the one who restored the gospel. And so I think for Mormonism to change, there's going to have to be a rethinking about many things written and spoken by Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. Now, the Mormons are smart people, extremely clever and ingenious, and so it's certainly, I'm not going to underestimate them in terms of being able to pull it off, but it's going to be very difficult.
It seems as though Joseph Smith and then to a lesser degree Brigham Young are really kind of they're the white elephant or the elephant in the room when you're talking to a Mormon. Sometimes it's laid out on the table. They'll open up the Book of Mormon introductory page, mm-hmm. and they'll read verbatim Joseph Smith's opening paragraph where he says these things actually happened and I wrote them down as they occurred, and then they'll just look at you as though this is self-evident.
Yes.
Joseph Smith said it so
yes.
Why would you argue with me?
That's right. That's right. Those two figures, both Smith and Young have shaped Mormon history. I mean, there's a university named after Brigham Young. It's going to be very, very difficult for Mormonism to move. There's some people have made different suggestions on how this could be done, but it's going to be very difficult. I know for a fact, that right now there are people within the Mormon Church leadership meeting with several evangelical scholars talking about, you know, theology. Sometimes there's vigorous debate. I can't mention any names because this is, I think, a very sensitive discussion, but this is for this past several, I think, 4 or 5 years, there have been meetings with leading evangelical theologians and scholars and some high-level people in the Mormon Church and other theologians within the Mormon Church to discuss these questions. And I think it's remarkable, and it's something that I think may result in some good things.
What needs to be done? We've talked about the emergence of a new LDS scholarly apologetic. It can be weighed on a case-by-case basis, but it's there nonetheless, and it needs to be responded to. We've talked about the relative ignorance of the average Mormon to what his church teaches. We've talked about a sophisticated apologetic that kind of runs through Mormon history. What needs to be done?
Well, I think we need to equip our own people who are studying at our seminaries, universities, and colleges. I think it would be wonderful for an evangelical university or college, perhaps a place like Baylor, where I'm on the faculty, to have a Center for Mormon Studies or a center for the study of alternative religious movements. Because what we have, I think what the academic Christians have done is have abandoned this important area of study and have left laymen to do it. Laymen who I admire for their diligence and their evangelism and the way in which I think they have forced us to see that this is a serious issue. But I think that those of us who are academics and scholars who have published in different areas, that we have to take seriously this issue. I think that future pastors, and I know Southern Baptist seminaries have picked up the mantle here. They have offered, largely because Southern Baptist Convention met several years ago in Salt Lake City, and they see the need. So I do think our academic institutions should be in the forefront. Our scholars should be writing and doing research in this area and responding to the LDS challenge.
Frank, you mentioned the importance of finding common ground with Mormon missionaries. Tom writes from San Angelo, Texas, "My wife is from Salt Lake City. When Mormon missionaries come calling, I usually comment that my wife is from Salt Lake. Immediately the question is she a saint?
Yeah.
I answer, yes, she's a Lutheran saint. That usually gets their attention and opens the door." What do you think?
That's great. That shows a sense of humor. I mean, I think one of the things that I've discovered over the years is that it's important that we don't take ourselves all that seriously, and I mean that in the best sense, that it's always difficult to discuss issues of theology with people with whom we disagree, but I think if we show ourselves to sort of be winsome and humorous, I think that can be helpful in breaking the ice.
Kevin writes this: "What's the best way to refute a Mormon when they say, we're Christian? They simply assert, we're Christian. Look, the name Jesus Christ is even in the name of our church."
Mm-hmm.
What's the best?
Good question. I think there's different ways you can deal with this. One, you can ask them, you can simply assert that you're a Mormon and ask them why that's false or true. You say, well, I reject everything Joseph Smith says, but I'm a Mormon. And they could, you know, at that point they'd have to, I mean, either say that you are or aren't, and they're going to say that you're not a Mormon. Well, on what grounds do you say I'm not a Mormon? Well, because you disagree with Joseph Smith. Well, look, I'm a Christian who's part of this grand tradition that goes all the way back to the first century A.D., and soon after that, the church established certain creeds and beliefs, and I'm part of that tradition, and these creeds are held by all the major Christian denominations. They're called Catholic creeds for that reason, and your beliefs are inconsistent with those. And I think I'm perfectly justified in saying that you're not a Christian on those grounds. I mean, our Jehovah's Witnesses claim to follow Jesus. Ask the Mormon whether Jehovah's Witnesses are Christians. Or what about world religions that try to incorporate Jesus in another way? For example, Muslims think Jesus is a prophet, so they treat him in high regard. Are they Christians? I mean, at some point, the Mormon has to give you criteria by which to distinguish his beliefs from others.
The issue of the apostasy, because if we go back to Joseph Smith and at least his stated impetus, mm-hmm, through divine revelation for getting this whole Mormon ball rolling, mm-hmm, is that the church had fallen into irreparable apostasy and that the cardinal teachings of Christianity had been lost over time and were not recoverable by any reform. They needed to start a new branch. Is this something that the average Mormon knows he is supposed to believe and believes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is essential to Mormonism. I mean, if there's one thing in common that you'll find even among people that who are adult converts to Mormonism, they will. The restoration is the most important thing. Now, of course, many of them are unaware of all the theological beliefs that went along with that restoration. For them, the restoration usually means the reinstitution of certain rites and ceremonies and the priesthood, the Melchizedek priesthood. So for us, we tend to be more concerned about the theological aspects of it, the doctrine of God and Christ, whereas they tend not to be. They tend to look at the reinstitution of a church rather than a belief system.
So would a good opening be to ask, do you believe that the Christian church fell into apostasy? Yes.
Yeah.
Detail that for me, please. What was lost?
That's right.
That needs to be regained?
That's a great question, yeah. And, of course, they will give you all the things that Mormonism did, or they'll give you the answer that Mormonism has all these things that the other denominations don't have. But, of course, that begs the question. Why should we believe that was the original that was lost? And, of course, then you're off and running.
Dr. Frank Beckwith, thank you very much for your time and being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Frank Beckwith is Associate Professor of Church-State Studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. He's co-editor of the book, The New Mormon Challenge. I want to recommend this book, folks, because this is the kind of book that you won't find on the shelves. It is a new chapter, if you will, in a solid Orthodox Christian response to the New Mormon Challenge. That's the name of the book, The New Mormon Challenge. If you'd like to receive a complimentary copy of our Issues Etc. journal, or if you'd like to donate monthly to Issues Etc. by becoming a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer, call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. You can also write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. This is a challenge that Christians ought to be happy, eager to take up. We have the truth. That should give us courage. We have a truth that the Mormon needs. That should instill in us a sense of urgency. When God sends the Mormon missionary to your door, you know, the Mormon prophet didn't send him to your door. The ghost of Joseph Smith didn't send him to your door. He didn't land there by random chance. If you're a Christian, you know what you believe, and God sends a Mormon missionary to your door, he's not sending him there so you can argue or to convert you to Mormonism. He's sending him there so that you can give the Mormon what they need most, and that is the truth about Jesus Christ, the only Savior of all mankind, his cross, his resurrection. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.
We usually think of the Reformation teachings of Martin Luther as radically Christ-centered, but they were more than that. They were cross-centered. Luther's theology is even called a theology of the cross. What is this theology? Our new Issues Etc. book of the month for October is called Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. You can order Lift High This Cross online. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and you'll find information about the book. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. 1-800-325-3040.
Jonah, 3,000 years in the whale?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the powerful and popular book, The Genesis Solution. Well, Ken, surely no one would even suggest Jonah was in the whale for 3,000 years. The Bible says 3 days, right?
Well, yes, the Bible records that Jonah was in the belly of a great fish for 3 days. But the reason I asked the question about 3,000 years was to point out a major inconsistency in the logic of some Christians. You see, I often have people say to me that the days of creation have to be reinterpreted because the Bible states that one day is like 1,000 years. Now, this verse has nothing to do with defining the word day in Genesis chapter 1 anyway. But here's where people need to be consistent. If someone claims that a day in Genesis 1 has to be interpreted as 1,000 years because of the verse in 2 Peter that says to God a day is like 1,000 years, then everywhere in the Old Testament where the word day is used would have to be changed to 1,000 years. Thus Jonah would have been in the fish 3,000 years. Well, this is ridiculous, of course. You see, the meaning of the word day depends upon the rules of the language, not some phrase in the New Testament.
This topic of the 6 days of creation is a crucial one. In fact, the gospel message is even tied to the question of the true age of the earth. Find out how when you read Ken Ham's free booklet on our website, AnswersRadio.com. Ken's booklet on the 6 days of creation is available free at AnswersRadio.com.
Bob 31, good evening. Coming up here in about a minute and a half, we'll conclude this hour, the final hour of Issues Etc. for today. That's the last half hour segment coming up. AMA 50K FUO weather, showers tonight, overnight low of 45, partly cloudy, 62 for us tomorrow. Right now it's cloudy and 66 in St. Louis. And traffic westbound 70 between Air Flight and St. Charles Rock Road, slow traffic. Also on westbound 70 on 94, right where 70 and 94 meet in St. Charles, slow spot there. Westbound 40 after Long Road, traffic out to Route K is slow. Westbound 70 between Cave Springs and Mid Rivers Mall, slow traffic. Eastbound 70 between St. Charles Rock Road and Cypress, there's heavy traffic. Northbound 55 between Park Avenue and the Poplar Street Bridge slow. And eastbound 40 between Compton and the Poplar Street Bridge slow.
Here's what's coming up on the Bible Study program. It'll be an Ask the Pastor program next time, and a rare appearance on Friday for Pastor Richard Moore of Emmanuel Lutheran Chapel in North St. Louis County. And then on Monday, Pastor Thomas Eckstein will be here to talk about 3 John. Listen to the Bible Study, weekday mornings at 10:05. Ask the Pastor next time.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Sunday night on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Oz Guinness. He's written a new book on prophetic untimeliness. We're going to be talking about the idol of relevance with Oz Guinness. That's live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. The remaining 25 minutes of Issues Etc. today we'll spend with Bruce Mason getting an update on the conclusion of a 2-day extraordinary meeting of the Anglican primates in London. It was called in response to the election of an openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA. Bruce Mason is media officer for the American Anglican Council. He joins us from London. Bruce, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you again for having me.
What has been the outcome of this meeting?
Well, it was a tough 2 days, so understanding is hearing from the primates. But today they put together a statement that we are very pleased with. It was a tough statement. It rebuked the Episcopal Church. It set into motion the beginnings of a process for discipline by the primates, which is something new. They have not been in that position before. They obviously haven't created a new province or anything at this point, but it has put the church on notice about the consecration, potential consecration of Gene Robinson in 2 weeks. And it's encouraging. I mean, some of the things they said specifically, they reaffirmed the Lambeth, they said the official policy of the Anglican Communion is reflected on human sexuality, that is reflected by the Lambeth Conference Resolution on Human Sexuality in 1998, which clearly states that homosexuality is contrary to scriptures and to God's will for people's lives, which essentially then is them saying to Orthodox Episcopalians in America that indeed you do represent the mainstream views of this Anglican Communion. So it was a wonderful statement of support for us and then a statement of rebuke to the Episcopal Church. And there's more, but perhaps you have questions.
Well, the latest news that I have, it calls this a unanimous statement of 37 national churches. Now, I note that there should be 38 there. Who is missing?
Well, one primate wasn't able to be there due to reasons that were either health-related or something. So just one primate wasn't able to come. So don't, that's nothing to read into.
Okay. What about Frank Griswold? He's among the primates.
Yes, he is.
Did he actually also join in this unanimous statement in condemnation of his own church?
It was a unanimous statement. He did, at the press conference that we had today, or that the Lambeth Palace had today, did seem to distance himself in one sense, that saying that somehow, even though the body of the church or of the primate said this, that somehow that distant, sort of a parsing of words, that somehow that individuals are somehow separate from the body. I don't agree with that. I think that's a little disingenuous if that's actually what he's saying. But nonetheless, he did say at the press conference that it indeed, what is splitting the church is the issue of Canon G. Robinson and his consecration. So I think it was a clear statement of recognition on the part of the primates that the Episcopal Church has stepped way out of bounds.
Gene Robinson, the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA, is scheduled to be consecrated officially on November the 2nd, you mentioned that just a moment ago. Does the statement by the primates promise any action if that consecration goes through?
Well, what it did is it essentially sent a warning saying, don't do it, to the Episcopal Church. And it says, if you do it, there will be consequences. And what they've done is they have basically tasked a commission specifically with the task of dealing with issues of discipline and figuring out what that process would be for discipline. So the discipline may not be immediate. But what they've done is set into motion a process to deal with issues of discipline, which is a huge step forward for the Anglican Communion. It also shows the growing role of the Anglican primates in the Anglican Communion. I mean, this is really unprecedented that they're actually now essentially moving to a place where they can have some say in other provinces, which is it's a major step. So again, they didn't come out with a dramatic sanction at this point, but what they did is they've given the Episcopal Church some time and saying, hey, listen, you've got, you can make a choice here with the confirmation. You can either go through with it or not.
The statement also asked national churches to, quote, make adequate provision for Episcopal oversight of dissenting voices within their own area of pastoral care in consultation with the Archbishop of Canterbury. What does this mean?
Well, and it goes further to say also in oversight of the primates as well. What that means, and the second part of that is the most significant. First of all, it means that there needs to be provision for those, for example, the Orthodox in the Episcopal Church who are in hostile places where their Orthodox views and are being they're being persecuted essentially for those views within their diocese, and that is going on. That provision will be made for them either by some bishop coming in to provide them with that pastoral care, crossing a diocesan boundary, that kind of thing, or some other provision. But what it's saying, the thing that's key there, is that what it's saying is that this isn't just something that an individual province deals with. This is something that has to be done in conjunction with Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and also under the primates. So what that is saying is that now the primates and the Archbishop of Canterbury essentially are involved in that process in individual provinces like the Episcopal Church, and that's a big step, we think, in the right direction as well. That's a big change. It's saying that provinces, there is some accountability now.
They also have a view toward, or at least anticipating, quote, individual provinces facing potential realignments. What does that mean?
Well, we've been saying from the start that what we're seeing now is a realignment in the church. And Ron Williams, at the press conference today, also did mention that one of the big outcomes of this meeting is that commission that we spoke about, and the fact that they will be dealing directly with issues of realignment. And realignment could mean, you know, new overlapping jurisdictions, new, you know, in other words, where a bishop can oversee areas outside his diocese, for example, or a province, an overseas province. Things can overlap. Or there could be a province in North America, you know. Again, it's opened the door for a whole bunch of possibilities. So we've crossed into that threshold. Now we're talking about real stuff and real real things that can possibly be done at this point. And that was a major hurdle I have to give a lot of credit to our African brothers and sisters and Asian brothers, brothers, primates who were there at this meeting, who really stood up for the faith. And it was a very highly managed meeting, as these things often are, very scheduled, very specific. But today, they stood their ground, and that's why the statement came out the way it did.
When the primates warn the provinces not to act precipitously, what are they warning against?
Well, they're warning against things like the Episcopal Church just did in terms of their vote to General Convention for same-sex blessing and to approve Lieutenant Gene Robinson as bishop. I would say that also would apply towards Gene Robinson's consecration. It would apply to the crisis that's going on now up in the Diocese of New Westminster in Canada, where you have a bishop up there just today going and inhibiting, which means essentially preventing 10 different churches and their clergy member or their clergy leaders from actually serving in the diocese just because they disagree with the diocese on the issue of same-sex blessing. So you have a lot of things happening right now. So the primates are saying, no, you can't do that.
So that would also apply to some of the mischief that's been taking place in the Episcopal Church USA in some of the bishoprics there, where people, rectors and other parish priests, have been refused a license to preach by their own bishop because they won't let their bishop come in and, say, do a confirmation or a baptism because of the bishop's liberal views.
Yes, I mean, I think this statement deals more on sort of the macro level in terms of a province acting in a particular way, but, of course, that is related to what happens below that as well. And so that I think that does tie in to some degree, but what they're tackling first is, bishops acting in certain ways or a whole province is acting in certain ways that are out of line with the rest of the communion.
We're talking about a two-day extraordinary meeting of the Anglican primates in London that just concluded today. It was called in response to the election of the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA. We're getting a live report with Bruce Mason, media officer for the American Anglican Council. He's in London. I'm a bit puzzled, Frank. I'm a bit puzzled, Bruce, about Frank Griswold, because before this meeting, he is writing letters that seem to be kind of thumbing his nose at the primates. He walks out of this meeting a more sheepish, more humble Frank Griswold. What is he going to do when he gets back to America?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? I'm sure there will be many folks that would generally side with him, that would be upset with what came out of the primates meeting. I don't know. I mean, he's in the position now with the consecration coming up in just a couple weeks of Gene Robinson, where he's got to make a decision. And you know, if he decides not to consecrate, well, he's going to be in hot water with a lot of folks in the Episcopal Church. But if he decides to go ahead and consecrate, he and the province is in a heck of a lot of hot water with the rest of the Anglican Communion. So, you know, at this point, I wouldn't want to be him.
Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727 if you'd like to join this conversation as we talk with Bruce Mason. How does it work then, Bruce? Who can prohibit? Can it be prohibited, or can Frank Griswold simply say, I'm not going to show up and lay hands on?
Well, yeah, there's a range of things I suppose he could do. I mean, he could go to Gene Robinson, and he could go to the diocese and say, listen, guys, you know, I strongly you know, I mean, he could say, don't go ahead with it, guys. And if, you know, they could still do it, and they don't have to necessarily listen to him. I mean, another bishop, I suppose, that bishops could come do the consecration. Griswold could assign another bishop to come do it, so he doesn't have to do it. He could be present or not present while that happens. It's unlikely. I find it that probably it would be unlikely that it doesn't go forward. I mean, I think that it probably will. But Griswold, again, his, whether he plays a central role or whether he just sort of steps to the side a little bit and sort of watches it happen remains to be seen.
Does that solve a problem? If he decides, I'm going to not go, I'll let another bishop do this, it's going to happen anyway, that doesn't really solve the problem at all.
No, it doesn't solve the problem. I mean, he might think somehow it moves. I mean, it gives him that sort of, it allows him to say, well, listen, I didn't do it. I didn't have anything to do with it. But in terms of the basic issue of it, no, it doesn't solve it at all.
Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, has shown himself very willing to submit, at least in his official capacity, to the will of Lambeth in 1998. Is a similar submission and cooperation expected with the primate's decision here this week?
Well, you know, he really did. I mean, we had numerous conversations with him. There was a special meeting, actually, that a couple of our leaders had with him just in the weeks before this meeting. And, you know, all along, and after also when he asked the bishop-elect or the appointed bishop in Oxford to step down, I mean, he has shown a clear understanding of how these issues can tear apart the fabric of our Anglican communion. He understands that. And I don't think he wants to be the person presiding over the communion when it goes to pieces. So he understands the gravity of it. What his personal views, I think, would side with the homosexual folks. But he has apparently been willing to set those issues aside for the greater communion. It's good.
How is the news today from London going to go over with the group that met last week in Dallas?
Well, once we kind of explain it, and once when primates make statements, they make them in ways that often take a little bit of interpretation because it's sort of church speech speak when they do it. But we pretty much, I mean, what we received from the primates was quite a bit of what we asked for. So I mean, so as I said, we're pleased. We would hope that those who were in Dallas were pleased. There's no way that everyone's going to be pleased because that's just not possible. But we're encouraged, and we hope that because we're encouraged, that other people will be encouraged too, and that they will know that the primates really have stood firmly with us.
One of the things that struck me as a little bit amusing, Bruce, is the relative lightning speed with which this actually occurred. I mean, between the election of Gene Robinson and the call of the meeting in Dallas and then the meeting of the primates and their decision, this is lightning speed for a normally glacial communion, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable how quickly this has happened. I mean, you know, but I will say a heck of a lot of prayer has gone into this, and we have seen things happen, things develop in ways that we could have never believed would happen. So it is pretty amazing. It's very fast for a communion that is known to grind along very, very slowly. You know, I thought from the very beginning, having just simply 2 days to deal with an issue that you know, is probably one of the biggest issues we've dealt with since the Reformation, frankly, was remarkable. But, you know, again, what they did here was very substantial, but it also marks the beginning, you know, and a lot depends on what the Episcopal Church does and what, you know, this commission begins to grind out in terms of processes for discipline and all those kind of things and what overlapping jurisdictions and other things might look like. So it's a very significant step forward. I think it addresses a lot of our concerns, but it things are still going to happen. I mean, there's still process to go through that, so to speak.
Is there any indication of who will serve on the commission?
Not yet, and that's obviously a concern of ours. So we hope that the Archbishop of Canterbury will put together a commission that fairly represents the makeup the makeup of the Anglican Communion in terms of the overwhelming Orthodox views of the Third World. So in other words, it's representative not by necessarily by country or nation, but by the percentage of people around the communion because the majority of the community is in the two-thirds will.
Explain the Lambeth process to us, if you would. Is this a regular meeting, or is this just something kind of that at his own pleasure, the Archbishop of Canterbury can call the leaders of Anglicanism, the bishops, to Lambeth Palace to discuss these issues?
This meeting was totally unprecedented. It's just not something that's happened. I mean, that showed the seriousness of this crisis we face. Normally what happens is every year the primates get together. And frankly, that's new. That started only a few years ago, this yearly meeting. And that was on the request of the Anglican primates themselves, the two-thirds world. They said, hey, let's get together more often. Before that, they were meeting every couple years, I think it was. And then every 10 years, you have a gathering of all the bishops in the church, of the worldwide church, and that's at the Lambeth Conference. The last one was in 1998, and that's the conference that spoke so clearly about the fact that the Anglican Communion upholds the traditional teachings on marriage and sexuality.
I guess what I'm asking is, can the Anglican Communion afford to wait until 2008 to meet again as a group of bishops?
Well, the primates will meet, you know, next year, probably sooner than that. The world body, you know, that raises a good question. Should they meet sooner or not? I mean, when that schedule was formed, we were in a world that simply didn't communicate like it does now. So, you know, I imagine those kind of issues will probably have to be addressed. But right now, I think they're just keeping to the every 10-year schedule.
We talked yesterday, and we got your reaction to Colin Coward. He was a meeting of a pro-homosexual group,
right.
And they had a worship service. They had big plans for this meeting as well. Any reaction from them since the primates have issued their statement?
Well, I haven't heard anything, but frankly, I've been running around so much that I haven't been able to check the news out. So I'm sure that they have put out a reaction. I know that there were definitely people from the homosexual lobby groups that were present at, you know, when we were interviewing. They were interviewing too, so they were around. So there's no doubt a response out there somewhere.
Let's go to the phones, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. On the line from Perryville, Willis, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yes, I was wondering, how large is the Anglican Church in Australia, and are they fairly conservative there or not?
Thank you very much, Willis. Bruce?
Well, I'm not sure the actual numbers in Australia. It's not a huge church. The Diocese of Sydney in particular is very conservative. The primate, you know, the head of that province, is not particularly conservative. It's kind of mixed.
Is this
in terms of where they stand?
Is this a first world, third world division between primarily liberal, primarily conservative?
I think what you're seeing here is really the rise of the global South. You're seeing it. You're seeing with your very eyes now the realignment of the Anglican Communion. That the power base of the Communion is increasingly now based in the global South. That those that have the greatest influence are increasingly becoming the global South, the two-thirds world primates and leaders. And that's because that is where Anglicanism is the strongest. It's no longer, you know, Anglicanism used to be sort of the colonial church, you know, that England was the mother church and all things flowed out of Canterbury. And now it's just a whole different church. It's entirely different. And so this is a phenomenon that's not just happening in the Anglican Church, but it's happening throughout the worldwide Christian Church.
And does that mean it will have a snowball effect as the population of Anglicans grows larger in the Southern Hemisphere? There will be more provinces in the Southern Hemisphere, more primates from the Southern Hemisphere.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, you have hundreds and hundreds of bishops and priests and there's no question that as the population grows and as Christianity spreads like wildfire as it is doing, that the church will continue to grow in the global South, particularly in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, but other areas as well. This trend will continue. There's no question about it.
So how is the American church viewed, not only as indicated from this two-day meeting in London, but by other indicators as well, by the rest of Anglicanism?
Well, I mean, at this point, I would say that they probably would view the American church through, I mean, I guess Archbishop Akinola really said it best. He's the Archbishop of Nigeria. He accused the West of really practicing a new cultural imperialism by exporting its, you know, its cultural mores and sexual mores over into the rest of the world. So I think that you know, along with the way the rest of the world views America anyway, just in the political sense, I think you see that also within the church. And they don't want, I mean, they don't want to see these things get exported onto them. So you know, definitely, they're very concerned. There's no question they're very concerned about the direction America's headed in. And that's why you see the primates having responded the way they did.
Bruce, thank you very much for being our guest, and get some sleep. It is almost midnight there in London, and we thank you for your time.
Not a problem. I'm always glad to be with you.
Bruce Mason is media officer for the American Anglican Council. He joins us from London with that live update at the conclusion of a two-day extraordinary meeting of the Anglican primates in London, called in response to the election of the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA. If you'd like to visit the American Anglican Council on the web, their website is AmericanAnglican.org, AmericanAnglican, all one word, .org. They also have a phone number, area code 202-296-5360. That's 202-296-5360. Friday on Issues Etc., Papal Authority and Roman Catholic Doctrine, Dr. Ron Feuerhahn of Concordia Seminary will join us for that two-hour conversation. We'll be talking about indulgences. We'll be talking about papal infallibility, purgatory, Mariology, the source of authority in the Roman Catholic Church. We'll be answering the question whether or not these things go back to the very earliest church or not. And then Sunday night on the program, a conversation that will tie nicely into the way we have ended Issues Etc. today. In an age when the church is trying harder than ever to be culturally relevant, what else was the Episcopal Church USA thinking when they ordained the first openly gay bishop? This is where the culture is going. The culture is calling the shots. In order to be culturally relevant, this is what we must do. It is our mandate. The culture has spoken. We will follow. In an age when the church is trying to be more culturally relevant than ever, why is it less relevant than it ever has been? Maybe the answer lies in the fact that in order to be culturally relevant, we have to give up what makes us relevant, that is, the truth of God's word, the gospel of Jesus Christ. Has the church traded the authority of Scripture alone for the authority of culture alone? We'll find out live Sunday night with Oz Guinness when we talk about the idol of relevance. That's from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.